Need a reason to smile? Comfort Dental has you covered with new patient exams, including x-rays, for just $19. That's right, only $19 to get started on a healthier, brighter smile. With convenient locations, flexible hours, including evenings and Saturdays, and a team that truly cares, Comfort Dental makes dental care easy and affordable. No gimmicks, no stress, just quality care when you need it. Get comfortable with Comfort Dental. Call or visit ComfortDental.com today.
The Magic Book Club with Benson's for Beds.
Hello, welcome back to the Magic Book Club podcast with me, Tom Price. This is the podcast where I find out exactly what makes our favourite authors put pen to paper and fingers to their keyboards. So on today's episode, I'm going to catch up with performer and writer Helen Paris about her gorgeous new book. It's called Lost Property. You're going to absolutely love it. And I predict you're going to love her as well. She's wonderful. And a little bit later on, I'm going to be chatting to the icon, the wonderful, the genius, Ruth Jones, about her lovely read, Us Three, which is out now in paperback. So sit back, pour yourself a cup of tea, get that dog on the lead, head out for the walk, keep the Magic Book Club podcast on and enjoy the show. So joining us now on the show, we have got, well, not just a writer, which I guess is the main reason she's here, also an actor and a performer. It's the fabulous Helen Paris, whose debut novel, Lost Property, is out now. Hello, Helen.
Hello, Tom. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming on the show. And we should say a little bit of background for the listener. It's the windiest day ever today, so we're sort of taking refuge to have a nice cosy chat about books. I like that.
I've been all around my house, Tom, trying to find somewhere where the wind isn't blowing sort of gale force through the windows. So I'm crouched in a corner of my bedroom right now, just so you all can get me site specifically.
Oh, good. I like that. I'll tell you what, site specific. I tell you what, talking of your performing history, I love a bit of site specific theatre. You can't go wrong.
You know, you can't go wrong. I think over the years, I've performed in California Redwoods on a beautiful windswept, keeping with the theme of the day.
There you go.
Beach in Hocum, beautiful Hocum in Norfolk, in a vintage bus in the East Midlands. You name it. I've been on it performing.
We should explain, shouldn't we? So site-specific theatre is this thing where actors put on shows anywhere, basically. And it's a magical thing. And I'm amazed it doesn't happen more often.
Well, do you know what I love about it most is that it often means that you get a different kind of audience that might not necessarily go and see your work or go to the theatre. Like, I remember I did a piece about the sense of smell, and because smell is so connected with home and sort of memories of home and of family, I set the piece in people's houses. So these wonderful people would volunteer their homes for the performance. So it meant that we ended up doing the shows in council houses, in Birmingham, and in beautiful apartments on the East Lower East Side in New York, and wonderful dilapidated buildings in Brazil, and ex-communist buildings in China.
What it means is,
the thing is, Tom, is that the next door neighbour gets interested in what's going on in the house, you know, in the flat, in the apartment next door, and rocks up and comes to the performance. So that's one of the many things I love about doing site-specific theatre work.
It is brilliant. It is brilliant. And, you know, to link it into the book, Lost Property, which is out now, do you think that your sense of place that you get from doing theatre shows like that was that useful? Did you inject that into the book? Because I feel a very strong sense of the Lost Property building, that sort of institutional big warehouse thing. I feel almost like I can smell it when I read the book.
Tom, absolutely. I mean, I was completely inspired to write Lost Property, the book, after doing a short stint, just for sort of 5 days in Lost Property in Baker Street in London. I was doing some research for a theatre project that was looking at loss and change. And I was so interested in sort of the materiality of loss, the lost objects. So my wonderful producer set me up in Transport for London's Lost Property office in Baker Street, which is coincidentally just down the road from, you know, Sherlock and Watson's pad in 221B Baker Street. And that also plays a little bit of a part in the book. But the basements in Lost Property are just filled floor to ceiling with all these lost objects just waiting to be found. And each one of them sports this mustard coloured, I'd say Dijon, if we're being precise.
Good, Dijon, I like the precision. We need a bit of, again, smelling it, already smelling it.
Absolutely. And it's very important to be precise in Lost Property. That can make all the difference as to whether your item is returned to you. So there's this sort of incredible visual display of colour as you go down to these cavernous basements, and you see this sort of kaleidoscope of colour and all these objects that have been lost, nestled up against each other, waiting for their owner. And, you know, I think if I hadn't gone and done the work in Lost Property, I could have imagined, you know, a sort of a huge amount of lost phones and brollies and shopping bags that filling the shelves. But yeah. I don't think I would ever have guessed about the false teeth.
Or the
200 and a weight of sultanas, or the replacement limbs, or the Chinese typewriter. So, you know, there really was something about going and being there and working there that really inspired me on that theatre project. And it's one of the reasons that, that the place of Lost Property took up residence in my imagination and stayed with me so much so that then I thought, you know, I think there's some more work I need to do here. And that was the beginning of the book.
And what a fantastic place to start, because Lost Property is this endless source of, it's just got everything in it. You've got nostalgia, you've got memories, you've got loss. And also the thing which I love most about it, when you describe the all the things in this place, is hope. There's a hope there, and it's really upbeat. I will look after this thing for you. You think it's lost and gone forever and someone's stolen it. It's not, it's here and I'm looking after it. There's a humanity in there somewhere.
You know, that absolutely is. There's a little comment that my protagonist in Lost Property, who's called Dot Watson, makes. And quite near the beginning, she's telling the reader, you know, I can't say a bad word about the people who return Lost Property. Last year, 13,000 keys were handed in. And she says, although unfortunately only a fraction of them were claimed, this discrepancy speaks to a heartwarming desire to help. And an absolute lack of hope. You know, so what she's referring to is that all those wonderful people who see, you know, some lost keys surrendered on the 73 bus and think, you know, somebody might want those, and they do the whole schlep over to Baker Street and hand them in, which I think is actually showing a real sense of sort of human camaraderie and hope. And then she's also sort of referring to a lot of people thinking, well, I don't know, I'll never find those keys again. No one would have bothered to hand those in. But the thing is, people do.
Yeah.
People do hand things in, and they hand in very valuable things, of course, but they also hand in things like, you know, the teddy bear with one eye missing, which, of course, is also equally valuable in a totally different way.
Yes, yes. And it speaks to holding on to things in this day and age, and that feels like a zeitgeisty thing. We are trying to throw less things away and hold on to things. Things are precious. Don't assume they're lost and gone forever. You know, there's a continuity there, which I love as well.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I was really found quite extraordinary was that you realise that loss is a real barometer of the times that we're living in, you know, that actually whole seasons are marked by loss. You sort of have mislaid umbrellas that flood in during all the winter months, although, you know, to be honest, let's face it, in Britain, all the months.
Constantly.
You know, and then in Wimbledon times, you know, suddenly it's lost tennis rackets, a go-go, you know. So there's that beautiful sense of, yes, you know, loss sort of really, really measuring the times. And also, you know, I remember when I was there was lots of A to Zs. I don't know how many listeners remember those A to Zs, but A to Z used to be the way that we would navigate London.
Yes, of course.
You know, now they've all been replaced by the other way we navigate London, which is the preponderance of mobile phones that are all in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're absolutely right about, there's the level of care that's not only given by the people that bring the lost property in that they found, but also I found really apportioned by the lost property workers themselves. And that really stayed with me, you know, that they know how important those objects are to people. And there was a real level of care and attention paid, whether it was a diamond ring that had been lost or that teddy bear with half its stuffing missing. You know, that's a sense of value being apportioned equally. Mm. And I think that was lovely. And that's attention and that sense of care really threaded its way through into the novel.
Yes. Yes. And there's a sense that as we see the lost property coming and going, and you say it's a barometer, which is it's a beautiful way of thinking about it. But that does make the people who work in the lost property office somehow observers, somehow are outcasts, somehow misfits. And Dot, let's talk about Dot, the main character. She definitely fits into that mold, doesn't she?
She definitely found her right place for many reasons, ending up taking the job at Lost Property. She is assiduous in how she diligently logs and labels every item that comes in, you know, and that could be an expensive leather wallet or a mediocre English essay, you know, if it comes in, then she logs it, she tags it, and she shelves it. Then it is lost property. And the lost property office in Baker Street doesn't actually have a uniform, but Dot, as I said, takes her job very seriously. She's fashioned her own uniform out of felt, because felt is a very supportive fabric. She has favourite words, sellotape, super glue and safety pin, because you know these are words that help us keep things safe and stop things from becoming lost. But she's also increasingly fond of the occasional nip of absinthe from an unclaimed bottle rolling around in the nether regions of lost property. And, you know, the reader starts to learn that Dot is actually as lost as the items that she diligently spends her day cataloguing. And her sort of years ago, her life veered unexpectedly, of course, and she's never quite recovered.
She yearns for that freedom again, doesn't she? And that the travel, and she, you know, here she is reading these travel books found in lost property. So there's a sort of caged bird element to her, which is so something people will really connect with.
Oh, caged bird, that's such a beautiful way of describing it. Yes, she has this, you know, because a lot of travel guides are left, particularly on the Piccadilly line that goes into Heathrow.
Heathrow, of course.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And, you know, often it's people either sort of getting ready for their journey, they're sort of reading up on it before they get to the airport, and then they just forget it in their sort of stress of, you know, travel stress. Oh, travel stress, to have that again. And then, or they abandon it on the way back from their journey, sort of to lighten the load of their case. Anyway, so many travel guides left on the Piccadilly line, folks. Dot collects them, and if they're not collected, she has sort of a library of them. And what she does is she sort of has her own travel exchange program, and she will look at a particular object left in lost property, like the particular sort of hang of a gabardine raincoat perhaps, and she'll look at it and she'll think, oh, I don't know, there's something slumping about the shoulders, there's something sad about the sort of the overstretched belt, as if the person's always trying to sort of give themselves a little bit more sort of support and, you know, get themselves a bit upright. I think what they need is a trip to Amsterdam, and she will slip 24 hours in Amsterdam, Baedeker's guide, you know, into their pocket, so that when the person collects their gabardine overcoat, they might then think, oh, I should just pop off there. And she imagines them sort of whizzing along the Herrengracht, you know, or tucking into a Stroopwafel. And she sort of prescribes it almost homeopathically that's the journey that they might go on. And so it's one of the many sort of idiosyncratic things that Dot does while she's in lost property.
But it's also got that thing which is such a great celebration of the power, the transformative, the travelling power of books that we all love so much. And hence the reason everyone's listening to this podcast today, because this is what we love doing. And it's fascinating that you have taken this turn in your career when you're going from working with people and collaborating as a performer and an actor and writing as a much more solitary thing. So how have you found that, Helen?
You know, it is much more solitary. Although what did surprise me is that, of course, theatre is so collaborative. And because a lot of the projects that I do, my company is called Curious, and so a lot of the projects start with a question, you know, like a project about smell started with, you know, well, how does smell connect with memory and emotion? What is it that when we smell something, we suddenly remember a person and feel sort of transported back to a particular place? Or working with them. So when you ask those questions, you need to find the people that you can help answer them. So I worked with a smell scientist in Bangalore in India, or to look at the veracity of gut feelings, you know, whether we should trust that feeling in our tummy when we think, oh, I don't know if I should go out today. Should we trust that feeling? Well, so then I went and worked with some neurogastroenterologists, a fantastic team in Barts, actually, in London. And it turns out that actually you should, more often than not, you should trust those gut feelings. So, you know, I'd always found theatre to be incredibly collaborative on that level, as well as obviously working with, you know, choreographers and musicians and technologists and stage managers. But what I found coming into fiction and working in the world of literature is that actually it is also extraordinarily collaborative. Yes, there are the hours upon hours upon hours that you want sitting, you know, bum to chair, yeah, pulling the hair out, you know, trying to get the work written. But there are also then this extraordinary team that come on board. The agent that is really fighting your corner and doing everything to get your book out. The editor is doing everything she can to make your book as word perfect as possible. Then all the incredible marketing and publicity that come in, you know, doing their damnedest to sell your book and get your book out there and get you on wonderful podcasts like this. So, you know, there is that other sort of collaborative infrastructure that comes in that is just wonderful because it is fueled by such a passion, you know. And I think if I wanted to say to people who were sort of wanting to get into that world of publishing, and, you know, it's, we all know that it's hard and we all know that it's competitive, you know, but we also know that people love books and need books now more than ever. So be inspired by that, but also be inspired by the fact that there is this extraordinary team out there who love literature as much as you do. Yes. But you know what I found is that when I make work for theatre, I'm often thinking, you know, of what the experience is for the audience. You know, how can I curate a particular experience for them, especially if I'm inviting them into somebody else's house and leading them out on an olfactory journey about smell. And even though when I'm writing the book, I'm thinking about the story. That's what I'm thinking about. I'm not thinking about the sort of the readership or when it goes out there. I'm thinking about the story. I'm thinking about Lost Property. I'm thinking about Doc Watson. But there then becomes a point in the progress when I do think about the audience, in this case, the reader, in the same way I think I want to have, you know, I want them to have an intimate experience. I want to create an environment that is, as you've so beautifully described it, is feels full of sort of sensuality that describes Lost Property in a way that they can feel it, that they can smell it, that is tactile, that is fully sensorial. So, you know, in another way, there is that sort of sense of a conversation with a reader that is really delightful and that is similar, but of course different. To what it is when I'm performing in front of them.
Yeah. But you get that thing as a performer where you have a very strong sense of an audience in your head. And I can tell that. It reminds me of reading Rachel Joyce. In fact, if any fans of Rachel Joyce will love this book, it's the same. You have a natural instinct for what an audience likes, along with, which is basically great storytelling and great character. And that is that. I wasn't surprised when I found out that you had a performing and a theatre background. I am, however, slightly surprised to find out you're also a professor at a couple of universities. Tell me about your time management, Helen. This is insane.
Well, you know, I do sort of adhere to that belief, the more you do, the more you do. You know, I do believe that. And I love teaching. I mean, I love working with students. I love encouraging them to make performance. So For the last sort of 8 years, I was working in Stanford University in California, working with some absolutely beautiful students, teaching them performance. And I've taught for the last 25 years, and I've just actually, with my other hat on, myself and my curious co-director, Leslie Hill, have just written a book based on 25 years of teaching. Called Devising Theatre, which is also coming out this year. And it's sort of a hands-on book for students, for artists, for teachers, for anybody who wants some tried and tested workshop exercises for people who are devising their own theatre work. Mm. And you know, the wonderful thing about starting to write fiction is also then letting myself, who's been a professor, let myself be a student, because I think it's a gift that we give ourselves to be students again, in whatever it is, you know, to learn how to garden, to learn how to cook. And I think we've been doing a lot of that over the last year, haven't we? Finding new ways of being and expressing ourselves in the world, because the world has been so different for us. So I love teaching. I love that. You know what I love most, I think, about teaching is working with a student on, and it's like a sort of a misty afternoon, and you're in a black box studio and people are trying out an idea.
Yes.
And, you know, the dust smokes it in the air, and you're in this sort of little black box space, and it's just this moment in time, but something, some little extraordinary moment happens, and it's not the show. It might never be in the final piece, but it's just this moment when a sort of moment of contact and communication is being made. And I love those moments, those raw moments. And I think what I also love about working with students and teaching, and I've had the privilege of being able to teach sort of in many places over the world, in Taiwan and in India and in China and in Australia. So really having this access to extraordinary different cultures. But what we do, what we all do when we make work, is we have this moment of exchange and communication. And I encourage people to make work in those raw moments that fails and flops and is gawky and ugly and unattractive, because there's also a beauty in that. And I think sometimes we have to make our so-called, I'm doing air quotes here, worst work to make our best work. And sometimes the work that fails is also gorgeous and you find something in that, you know.
You're just the best advert for a curious mind I've ever spoken to, Helen. It's just fantastic. This creativity, this curiosity, this fearlessness, because you've got to be fearless to embark on any career, whether in the creative arts, whether it's theatre, academia, whether it's writing, you have to throw yourself into it. And it's from doing that that we have the disasters and the failures, but then we learn the resilience and you end up making a beautiful book like Lost Property. And it's such a great... You know what, Helen, you're an example to us all. That's what you are.
Oh, bless you. I'm still reading from the Rachel Joyce, you know, sort of connection, because she's absolutely extraordinary writer. So I can basically die happy now. No. With that, because she's absolutely wonderful. But that's, do you know, true. What I think is so important for us now more than ever, because we all know about all the cuts that are happening to the arts, and we have to keep on keeping on. We have to keep on making our work. We have to keep on, whatever the odds, we have to keep on, because contact and communication is more important now than ever. And we know that from all the books that we've read. Mm. We know what's happened to all our wonderful live artists, you know, not being able to perform over the last year. We have to support each other in our creative endeavours, because they are so important.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, your book is, it's been loved by many people. In fact, there's a quote on the front of the book I've got here. Rich, funny and brimming with heart. That's by Beth Murray, a.k.a.
Oh, lovely Beth Murray.
A.k.a.
Yes.
My wife. So...
Oh, well, she's another example of this woman who is such a beautiful writer in her own right, and yet is so there championing other writers and other books. And I love that world of Twitter, actually. I'm such a newbie to it, you know. I sort of hung in the back, you know, like a wallflower. But my God, you get people like Beth that are just out there reading the books and putting the word out about them. And that's what this writers' community does, and that's what programs like this and podcasts like this do, Tom. So thank you, and your wife.
I'll pass that on. She genuinely loved your book. She was reading this long before you'd been booked for this, and she said she was really, really enjoying it. So when I heard it was you were coming on, I was absolutely thrilled. It's also, that's very, very interesting. That's really resonated. Having seen Beth become a writer in the last couple of years, and the online communities, Facebook communities for writers and stuff like that, it is really useful. It has been really nice to see the positive side of social media and to see that collaboration element. You know, you talk about the isolation of writing, the social media backbone that other writers give each other is worth giving a shout out to, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Yes, can't speak about it highly enough. That's the way that we survive and thrive. You know, we support each other, we read each other's works, and we support, you know, get each other's books out into the independent bookstores as well.
Yes, absolutely. So, Helen, I mean, slightly obvious question, but looking at this book, you know, is there a theatre show in this book? Is there a TV show in this book? Do you think there is a future for it in that sense?
Well, the thing is about loss, it just never stops, does it? It's universal, I think, that we can all relate to. I mean, I think what the book really tries to do is to talk about loss in all its myriad forms, you know, and it's... what I think the real statement of the book, the heart of the book, is that loss is the price that we pay for love, you know, and I think it's a portrait of loss, whether it's about losing your brolly or losing your way in life, or there's also a dementia story that threads through. And there are also joyful losses. There's one moment where Dot really loses her inhibition in a Camden Club in a rowdy line dance class. So
she's a great line dancer. I really love how she lost her inhibitions. I felt like, God, imagine if I could ever do that without alcohol. That would be a miracle.
She does have a little bit of a snifter, I think, before she goes down there and starts doing her boot scooting shuffle. But you know, yes, I mean, I think I am not the person to make that. You know, I've done some work with loss in through theatre performance, but I think there are other stories to be made from this, absolutely, because I think it's universal, isn't it? And I think one of the things that I love about objects is that objects, that tactile memory, when we hold objects, we know how meaningful they are to us, how they can, holding an everyday object, a pipe, a bag, a small purse, can contain in its body like a memory, a trace of a life lived, of a person loved. I think objects can be portals through their shape, their smell, their memories, and can let us time travel back to the past. So I think those sort of things now maybe more than ever, are really important for us to connect and hold on to. So yes, I would love to think there's a lot of fruitfulness in this whole world of loss that we can connect to in its myriad ways and shapes and forms.
The thing I kept thinking about when I was reading this was, what is the item that I would most like to find? What is the lost item? And yes, the one for me, which I'll say to give you a chance to think of yours, because that's the inevitable question at the end of this. But the one for me was a Swiss Army knife my dad bought me when I was 10 years old. I loved that thing and I treasured it, and I lost it when I was about 12. I only had it for a couple of years, but it was so fantastic. It had all it had 26. I don't know why I remember that precise detail. It had 26 different things on it, different knives, and obviously very good for horseshoes, magnifying glass, all that sort of stuff. And the way I treasured that item. So that's the thing I would like to most find if there was a magical lost property.
Now, Tom, did you go to Lost Property and check for that? Because it might have been their Dot. Maybe they would have labelled it and logged it and put it down in the basement.
Go find Dot. Help me, Dot. it's good 20 years ago now. What about you, though, Helen? What's the thing, if you could dive into a magical lost property office, what is the thing you'd most like to find?
Well, there's a few. In terms of loss sort of being the barometer of times, I love a nice pair of sunglasses, but because we only get to wear those for like maybe a couple of weeks in July, so we don't become habituated to them, I'm losing them all the time. So I think I've got a stack, an Elton John supply of sunglasses, or Jackie Onassis supply of sunglasses, yes, down in Lost Property somewhere. And then I remember my dad had this beautiful jacket that he'd wear at the weekends, and it was the jacket that he'd go out in and just sort of garden in it. And then he did smoke a pipe, so it would smell of tobacco and it would smell of him. And then it was replaced by a new one, and I was devastated, sort of 8 years old and just in bits, that this coat had been lost. So he'd bought himself a new one, and it was smarter, it was cleaner, it didn't have all the holes, and so of course it was meaningless to me because it didn't smell of him.
Yes, these random items that we build our little worlds on. It's extraordinary.
They become redolent with memory. They really do. They're quite extraordinary. Because you don't just remember your mum's bag. You remember your mum's hands as she opened the clasp of the bag, and how she'd rootle inside it. You remember all of that physical choreography that sort of brings that person back. So, our tactile memory is extraordinarily strong.
So true, so true. Well, I've got a lovely new item, and it is the beautiful hardback copy of Lost Property by Helen Paris, which is out now. Helen, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, you pop it, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome along to the Magic Book Club podcast. I am absolutely delighted to welcome one of our finest actors and an incredible writer to boot. It is the fabulous Ruth Jones. Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm living in a bubble of optimism that the world might finally be coming back to a little bit of normality. So
yes. Now that is a bubble I can get on board with.
But don't get on board too aggressively, because you might burst it.
Yes.
And fall to the floor.
That is the thing about bubbles. They're very delicate. Oh, my God, that's the most amazing way into your book, Ruth. Yes. What a segue. Look. So let's talk about the book. Us Three, it's out now. And it is about this. It's out now in paperback, I should say. And it is about this fabulous, tight-knit group of friends who form this sort of bubble that floats over the years as the years go by. And it's a beautiful thing.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for that. It's out in paperback now. It came out in hardback last September. And it was a real labour of love. It was a real joy to write. And in some ways, I felt it was my first novel rather than Nevergreener. Obviously, I'm very proud of Nevergreener. But Nevergreener was based on a screenplay that I wrote back in 2002. And Us Three was absolutely from scratch. And I wanted to move away from the arena of like love relationships, which is what you find in Nevergreener, is a very sort of quite a toxic relationship in that. And I wanted to go into a different arena. And I thought, well, female friendship and long-term female friendship seemed like a good place to explore. I am very privileged to have friends in my life who I've known since infant school. And I was able to sort of delve into that side of my own life, I suppose. And I wrote this story, and it's about three women, three very different personalities. I describe them as being as different as chalk, cheese and chocolate. And they were friends from day one of infant school in the fictitious town of Coedcelyn, Lana, Catherine and Judith. And they, when they were eight, they swore on a curly-whirly wrapper in the playground that they would always be there for each other, come what may. And really, the book is about the strength of lifelong friendship and whether or not, it can withstand what life throws at us, because something does happen to unbalance this perfect equilateral triangle of Judith, Lana and Catherine. And it's all about how they navigate this upheaval in their friendship.
It is fantastic. And I love seeing friendships on a journey, because that's something that we can all relate to. And also as a Welshman as well, I love it starts in Wales, which is this comforting, surrounded by family. It makes me want to move home when I read those first few chapters and I'm in the flashbacks to the 1980s. But this idea of home versus moving on, going out, going to, well, in Lana's case, going off to drama school, or Catherine even going to Cardiff, as far as Cardiff. This idea of home friends versus post, I guess you'd say post school friends, and how they mix and how that sort of develops. That's really interesting. I love that stuff.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's funny. Somebody said to me the other day that often when you have a novel or a drama that's set in a small town, that, you know, it's all about the characters and they're wanting to escape. And like, as you say, the girls do go on their own different journeys, but the town of the fictitious town of Coedcelyn is always very much part of the three girls' reasons. And for me, again, there is something about having that, like a sort of a code of reference that you all share. So, like, I'm from Porthcawl, which is a seaside town in between Cardiff and Swansea on the Welsh coast. And my mum still lives there. All my siblings live there. And some of my dear friends still live there. And so it's really interesting to see how time moves on. And, you know, my mum has been living in Porthcawl since 1950 or something like that. I mean, that's 71 years. So I just love the way that I was able to dip in, although I must emphasise that Coedcelyn is not Porthcawl, but I did take little bits of my own upbringing and the privilege of being able to live in a town and go to school for my entire school life. I went to lived in the same town. My parents had lived there for years. There's something about that sense of belonging, I think, that's really, really valuable. So I nicked little things like Mills's Cafe was a real place in Porthcawl. And it's just nice to have those things that survive the entire journey of the novel that spans three decades.
Okay, so that's what it is. I'm glad you said that, because the belonging is the word. I feel like I've cracked Ruth Jones now, because when I watch and love Gavin and Stacey or Stella or read these books, you've got an ability to make us feel like we belong. What are your weapons? What are the things you deploy to make that work? Because you do it in a magical way. We all feel like we belong to these gangs and these groups, and we relate to your stuff. And I'm fascinated to know what it is.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think my writing always starts with characters rather than maybe a very sophisticated plot device. I mean, sometimes I wish I did have a sophisticated plot device, but I think you can find plot in character, you know, from character. You can develop plot from character. So I think there's something about, you really have to make the characters, if you believe in the characters and you feel like you've got to know them. And a lot of people have read the hardback of Us Three have said, oh, I really felt like that they were my friends, you know, by the end. Yeah. I think that's possibly what it is. It's about detail and detail of character and just making the reader, I hope, believe that they are real people with real experiences. And I think also for me, a really important tool, as it were, comes from the fact that I'm an actor. So dialogue is really, really important to me. And I I will read aloud the character's dialogue just so that I know it works. Because often, I know for me, I could be reading something that I really love, but sometimes if the dialogue doesn't ring true, I'm like, I don't think anybody would actually say that, you know. Yeah. So I think dialogue's really important, and character, and just inviting people into that world.
Yeah, and fun as well. You know, it is. There's so much fun. There's so much comedy, as you'd expect. It's Ruth Jones, for goodness sake. But also, you're dealing with heavy things, mortality, for God's sake, and awful. I mean, Patricia, the narcissist, Patricia. There's so many horrible things. Whereas when you watch something like, say, Stella, obviously there's serious moments in that, but comedy and love is what drives it. Whereas in this book, you dabble in things like mortality, and it's really. It's gut-wrenching when it's done well. Aww. So, you know, it's do you find that's a stretch? Do you find yourself, here's the question, I knew there's a question at the end of this, do you find yourself pushing yourself? Do you feel when you write these books, this is new territory for me as a writer?
I've been lucky that I haven't had to go through the awfulness that some people have had to experience in terms of grief. I've experienced loss. And I think it is a shared, it's something that you do share. I mean, one of the joys of lifelong friendship is that you do pass through life's milestones together. And those milestones can be, you know, like I've often said this, the friends that were there when we entered the school I Stedford when we were nine and got the wrong poem, and the friends that were the same friends that were there when I passed my driving test, or when I got married, or at my dad's funeral, you know, and so there's something really special about sharing with friends that you're fortunate enough to have for a long time, sharing those things with them. And I think sometimes, like, obviously I don't want to spoil the story, but, you know, some of the things you're alluding to in there, they did make me really sad. And also there's some real joy in there. And I was like, oh, there's something so delicious about when it all falls in place, when you're writing and you go, oh God, that's got to happen. That's got to happen. You know, and when I think back to my original treatment for that novel, it wasn't quite what ended up happening. And I think that is part of the joy of the discovery of writing a novel, is that you suddenly go, wouldn't it be really good if I went in that direction? And sometimes those are for really heartbreaking reasons or for really joyous reasons. I hope people will share that. Yeah.
This idea that writing is a lonely task. It's not true, because you're surrounded by all these people and all these things that could happen at any moment.
Yeah. I mean, you're not alone in the sense that you've got your characters with you, and you know, even the bad characters, like you mentioned Stella, and I always think you know, Stella didn't really have any baddies in it. It had a couple, but essentially they were nice people. I mean, you were in Stella, and your character was kind of like he wasn't a bad.
There was a word. There was a word that. That producer and writer David Peat used to describe my character. I can't, unfortunately, repeat on this podcast, but it was spot on.
That's that, you know, you want to enjoy being irritated by characters or being completely frustrated by them. And I think in Us Three, one of my favorite characters is Patricia, who you mentioned. Patricia is Judith's mother, and she's awful. She's awful. And but she was a delight to write for because of that reason. You know, she really was. And her, that situation, again, I don't want to go into, but there's something that happens to Patricia in later life was based on a real experience of a friend of mine, and the same thing happened to her mum, and you know, you just go, you can't, I, you know, if I read that, would I believe that really happened in real life? Well, it really did happen. So yeah, it's good to have the baddies in there as well.
Do you have to get the nod from people if you're gonna use something that's happened in someone's life? Do you feel the urge to sort of get in touch with them and say, listen, I'm putting this in my book, is that okay? Or do you feel like you're fictionalizing it enough for it to be harmless?
I'm really sensitive. So if I ever have used something like I described, and I just did check it out with my friend. I mean, you wouldn't know who it was. So that's that. No. I was really careful with that. But, you know, and and there are some things that I take a risk with and I go, but they're very benign things. So for example, Mills's Cafe that I mentioned earlier, that's my friend Lisa, her dad ran that cafe, but there's nothing detrimental to say about that. So, and she was just really touched that it was in there. And often, you know, people, there are little things that only certain people will recognize. They go, oh, I noticed you put X, Y, and Z in. And I think that's quite a nice sort of testament to friendship, you know, to my friends, I guess, to put little things in here and there.
Yeah. This book is bursting with friendship and love, and it's such a good read, and it's out in paperback now. Ruth Jones, Us Three. We've run out of time on the Book Club podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. I could talk to you for hours, but time is a problem. Time is a problem. Dealt with beautifully in this book, but thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. It's been an absolute pleasure as ever.
Ruth Jones there, absolutely wonderful. And if you love Gavin and Stacey and Stella and all those shows, I cannot recommend this book enough. It's just like diving into a book version of those wonderful TV comedies. It is a really, really great read. If you love Marianne Keyes, you're going to love this book. And that's it for the Magic Book Club podcast. Join me next time for brilliant stories from fantastic authors. And as ever, head over to magic.co.uk to see the rest of our May picks and join the club for yourself. And of course, in the meantime, happy reading.